Ireland may be a small island on the edge of a continent, but our unique mix of animals and plants gives us a fascinating natural history. This series celebrates the animals that share our island, and we meet some of the people who know them best. I'm Colin Stavridge-Johnson, and this is Nature on One. This week, I'm going to be investigating birdsong. Why birds sing, how they sing, and do we even notice them anymore? I've come to the Devil's Glen in County Wicklow, and these are the woodlands of my youth. I spent hours exploring this place, and it still sounds the same today as it did back then. That's the great thing about birdsong. This morning, I'm going to meet up with Nicola Marples, and when she's not wandering around the woods listening to birdsong, she's the head of the Department of Zoology in Trinity College, Dublin. So, Nicola, why do birds sing?
Well, there's really two reasons why they sing. They sing to defend their territory, and they also sing to attract a mate. But it's the same song. So a male bird will go up into the top of the tree and sing really loudly. And if he's got a mate already, then he's singing to defend his territory from the neighbours. If he hasn't got a mate yet, then he's singing as loud as he can, both to attract her from a long way away, but also to show that he's a big, strong male, because singing is really hard work. And so he could only do it for a long time if he was a big, strong male. And that's what the women want. They want somebody big and strong.
I see.
Got good genes, those good genes are going to get passed on to her kids.
I guess if you spend a lot of time singing, it means maybe there's a lot of food availability in that particular area and that sort of thing.
Yeah, it suggests that he's got plenty of food in him. He's not pressed for time in foraging. So he's found enough food that he can waste it by singing it away.
And how do they produce such sounds?
They've got a special organ. So we've got vocal cords. They've got a thing called a syrinx. And it's slightly different in that they can sing two notes at once, which is quite nice. So they can sing in harmony with themselves, which is quite cool. So you could have a whole chorus just by one bird.
Fantastic. And so it's a very complex thing, and it always amazes me how, you know, you'll have a bird and then its first year, its first breeding season, it flies to the top of a tree and starts this amazing song. But how much of that is kind of inherited, and how much do they learn?
They learn, well, most species learn it all. When they're in the nest, they're little tiny babies, and we think they're not really listening to anything going on around them, and they just cheep at that point. But they're actually listening to their dad or whoever is nearest to the nest singing away, and they learn his song that way. And because they learn it from their dad, it means that the local area gets sort of like a dialect. So you have a blackbird singing with a Cork accent, effectively in Cork, and you'll have a Dublin one singing in Dublin and so on.
Amazing, amazing. And I'm just wondering now, I'm just thinking, but like you're a little chicken, you're sitting in the nest. I wonder how you know it's your dad that's singing. It could be the dunnock next door.
There's a genetic propensity. So their genes are telling them what to learn for preference, but their environment is giving them that opportunity. So they have to have dad around in order to learn to sing. And at which point you think, okay, but what about something like a cuckoo who's living in someone else's nest? Does he come out singing reed warbler? But he doesn't. He comes out singing cuckoo. And they're just special because they will learn it later in life, and they'll learn it from their own species. And again, they've got quite a strong program, if you like to think of it that way, in their genes that says, don't learn anything except cuckoo. And eventually you'll hear a cuckoo, don't panic. And eventually they hear one, and so therefore they can sing it.
Amazing. Never thought of that. We all have different experiences of birdsong. Birdsong forms a backdrop to our everyday lives. Some of us notice it and recognise the changes through the seasons or what species is singing, while others just enjoy the tunes. And many of us don't hear it at all.
I mean, I think birdsong is just, it's such a beautiful contribution to my life. I moved up from to the city from the country, and I really missed the sound of birds in the morning. So now I open my window in the morning to really make the most of it, and I've started listening to CDs of birdsong as well, especially when I'm reflecting or doing some yoga. I find it absolutely beautiful.
I usually come here to jog or to go for a walk, but it's not something I really notice or have noticed before, because I'm usually wearing headphones. Now to stop me, it is quite loud and quite noticeable, but I wouldn't be able to tell you one bird from another, really. It's not really something I'd be into anyway.
I was taught the names of birds by my mother and the sounds of birds by my grandmother down in County Clare. And I'd say at about 11 years of age, I was out with my rickety cassette recorder in the back garden in October, listening to blackbirds settling down in the twilight, which is, to me, one of the most evocative, beautiful sounds of the Irish autumn. I know during the snow last winter, about 12 different types of bird came to our little suburban garden in Rathmines, and that was, to me, was quite miraculous. That is wildlife.
Now, birds sing to defend territories, attract mates, but they've lots of other calls too.
Yeah, they when they're travelling in a flock, you hear a lot of little tiny squeaky noises where they're talking to each other, trying to hold the flock together. Those are called flocking calls, and they're just little squeaks and peeps and so on, where effectively what they're saying is, I'm over here, where are you? And it holds the flock together as a cohesive unit. They also have a sort of high-pitched squeak which they give when they hear a predator coming or when they see a predator coming. And that that squeak is a very specific shape. If you can think about a sound as a shape, it starts very gradually and then it carries on being a very stable single note, and then it gradually reduces again. And that's designed that way because it's very unlocatable. Because we locate, and animals locate sound by effectively the edges of the sound, the staccato. Turning on and turning off of the noise. So a gradual onset and a gradual offset makes it very hard to identify where it is. And of course, that's a good idea if what you're doing is yelling, here comes a predator, because you don't want the predator to know where you are.
Of course.
So a lot of different species have exactly the same sound of a very high-pitched squeak. And high-pitched is good because it doesn't travel very far.
So the predator mightn't hear it. So you're just telling your mates.
Yeah. So you can just say to the guy next door, hey, here comes a predator, everybody hide. And it's a good idea to get everybody moving simultaneously, because if the predator then does see your flock, then it's unlikely to be you that he picks out, because everyone's moving. It also confuses him, so it's harder for him to catch a single individual. So it's not kind. They're not being helpful to everybody else. They're basically trying to hide amongst the flock.
Look, I have a couple of sounds here on my tape recorder someplace, which I believe are those very sounds that you're talking about, or something very similar. Now, the first one, can you identify this one?
Yeah, that is a blackbird. Amazingly, it's a big bird, but it's making a very high-pitched little squeak.
And not the tradition. Most people think when they hear a blackbird alarm call, it's that
noise, yeah.
Which is locatable.
Which is much more locatable. If a bird wants to be located, then it gives a much more staccato call. But if it doesn't want to be located, it's doing these simple calls. And we'll come back to a locatable call in a minute. It's interesting that different species have different ones of these calls.
Well, as it happens, if I can just fiddle with this here for a moment. That, I believe, is a robin.
That is a robin, yes. So it's much, much smaller bird, but it's giving pretty well identical call, because they're using the same language to tell each other that a predator is coming. And it's also because it's so well adapted to not being locatable. But another interesting thing about that call is that we should be taking note of the fact that that's unlocatable, because our ambulances and fire engines have a sort of wee-wee-wee-wee call, which is also quite unlocatable because it doesn't have clear onset and offset sounds. And so, therefore, all the cars in the area don't know where the fire engine is. And so presumably it's designed that way so that everybody slows down because they've no idea where the engine, where the fire engine is.
Yeah, absolutely right. You hear that sound and you think it could be ahead of you, behind you, or coming in either side of you. And so you're generally looking in the mirror and looking all around.
Yeah, and you slow down as well, even if it's miles from you, in fact.
Yeah, that's
so
interesting.
If they want us to be able to locate it, they need to make it be
like they are maybe
easier
in America. You know, the American fire engines,
yes,
they sort of blow horns and this staccato sound.
Yeah.
As they come roaring up behind
you.
Yeah,
and that's much easier to identify where it's coming from.
Now I can hear a cock crowing somewhere in the distance. That's a highly locatable sound.
If a bird wants to identify exactly where it is, if it's calling a female, for instance, it's actually wanting to say, I'm right over here. It doesn't want to call the female and have her go to the neighbour. He wants the female to come right to him. So he then has a very different call, which is very loud, quite low pitch usually, and with locatable bits in it. And so something like a red grouse, for instance, the red grouse has a very, very locatable call, and it goes effectively, and it's a low pitch, so it goes a long way, and it has all those nice edges in it so that it can be identified, located very easily by the female, so she'll come right to him and he'll get his mating.
Well, you know, I'm going to see how good your impression was. It is. And I know that sound from walking in the mountains, and you do know exactly where it's coming from.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking too, that cockerel sound, you know, I work in India a good bit, and you hear, you know, the jungle fowl up there in the mountains,
yes,
in the forests up there. And it's amazing how similar they sound to that bird that's been domesticated for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
The sound is carried over all those countless generations. And so you can hear them today in Wicklow, and they sound pretty much like the wild birds their ancestors did.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they haven't changed very much at all. And that is surprising after all those generations of breeding. But I guess that a species needs to keep its call very identifiable, because that's its breeding passport, effectively. If the females don't recognise it as being the right species, then they won't come and mate with him. So he has to have the right call in order to be able to get matings.
But you know, there are some birds I've noticed around the world, and we've got some examples of them here in Ireland, where they actually mimic the calls of other birds.
Yeah, and that doesn't make any sense when you first think about it, because they're copying a species which isn't their species, so surely that's going to confuse the females into not mating with them. But a good example of this is starlings. They'll do that. They'll do very nice mimicking of all sorts of sounds that they hear in the environment, like
there's
car
one
alarms.
There was one I have living just near me at the moment, and he makes the most perfect curlew sound.
Right.
And I wondered why a curlew was calling from a telephone wire.
Yes.
And then I realised it was a starling doing a perfect curlew impression.
Yeah, and what's going on there is they'll actually do starling sort of crackle noise, and then curlew, and then starling crackle noise. So hopefully what's going on is that the females will recognise the starling crackle noise and know it's a starling. And what they're doing is they're trying to improve their repertoire. They're trying to get a bigger collection of songs to be able to sing.
Sure, I suppose that, like a lot of behaviours evolve, you see it in other kinds of birds, whereby the more time birds have on their hands, the more complex their behaviours can become. I'm thinking of things like birds of paradise and barrow birds, because they're fruit eaters, they can get their food very fast, and then they've all day to sort of behave and do other things.
And all day to impress the females with.
Yes.
So another thing about having a repertoire is that the female is going to think, wow, he's learned 48 different songs. He must be a big, hunky guy. And he must have a lot of food on his territory because he's wasted that long doing it. And probably he's also probably quite old. And being old is a good thing for a bird, because it
being
means
an old male is a very good thing. I'm always trying to convince people
myself. Oh, yes, absolutely. But the women like it for, in birds. They don't like it quite so much, I'm sorry to tell you.
The odd one.
But the birds, it's a great thing because it suggests that you've survived a winter, and surviving a winter is a good indication of good genes again. So what the females want out of these males is both parental care but also good genes. So him being able to demonstrate that he's survived for a reasonable length of time in order to collect all these songs is a good...
It's a good indication of fitness. And
yes, good fitness indicator.
Parenthood. I've got on my little box of tricks here, I've got... we've been chatting about startings lots, so this is a... I suppose a fairly normal, standard starting call. It's great, isn't it?
And all that crackling in the middle is the bit that says, I am a snarling, don't worry about what species you're hearing next.
Yeah, so if I'm suddenly a great tit and then a curlew and then a woodpecker, it's grand,
grand. That's right.
I'm actually a starling and I'm still attractive. And then now I found a few other calls which fairly well demonstrate their ability to mimic other species, and not just other species, other things, I suppose. That, I believe, is a mobile phone. Yeah. And you know the bit at the beginning? That's the vibration. It's as if the phone's been left on the table. It's a bit like my one, and this annoyingly vibrates before it rings. So whoever he was living with had one of those phones.
One of those.
Great sound.
It's amazing how they can get that accuracy of sound as well. That's a starling talking. And what he's doing is he's mimicking his owners. And that's remarkable because it's very interesting that if you keep a starling in the house and you keep him in a cage, so he's not part of the family, he won't do that. He won't copy speech. If you keep him as part of the family, if he's part of the social group, then he will copy the speech. So he ends up acting like a parrot and speaking like that, actually able to copy human speech. But it's amazing that they actually will only do that if they're socially close to human beings. And that suggests that this ability to copy has something to do with a sort of cognitive connection or a social connection somehow.
Wow.
Hello. Hello.
Lloyd Buck is a bird trainer who has a tame starling called Arnie, who not only mimics his voice, but enjoys his piano playing.
Ready, Arnold? Did you like that? He's a good lad. What we discovered about Arnold is that he really likes the piano, but he seems to prefer classical music. And in the evening, or quite often he'll be sat in his little travel box in the evening, and he'll sit there and he'll listen, and he joins in his own way with his own little repertoire, don't you, Arnie? Whereas at the minute he's just swearing for his food. But the really interesting thing is that Mozart, the classical composer, had a pet starling. That he was meant to have been wandering in the street or walking through the street, and he heard in a pet store a starling singing some of his music. And he was so taken with this, he went in and bought the starling, which he kept for a number of years in his home. And what he was really impressed with, it wouldn't only imitate his music and little bars of it, but it would also improvise and make its own version of his music. So it was almost composing itself as well. And when it died, he was meant to have been so distraught, he composed a whole array of songs that were basically dedicated to this little starling. So they do seem to like classical music, don't you? Although he likes Beethoven, I've noticed. That's your favourite, isn't it? It's really relaxing, mister. Yes, isn't it? It's a good boy.
Speaking of ambulances, I've got a pretty cool sound right here someplace, and try and have a guess of what's... That's apparently a blackbird.
I find that very amazing. I've never heard of a blackbird mimicking before.
Neither have I.
Amazing. It's really convincing as well.
It is. It is very convincing. I guess all these things, and this is what they're doing in the wild. They're picking up all normally natural sounds, and it could be anything, just to add to that repertoire, to just make them sound attractive to females.
Yeah, there's a nice story about why repertoires might be going on, which is borrowed. It's called Beau Geste, and that's because it's borrowed from a Voltaire story about a legionnaire who was defending a castle, and he was with his set of soldiers, and the enemies came in. They killed everybody except him. Presumably he was hiding in the cellar somewhere. He came out, found all his colleagues dead, but the enemy had gone off, I think, to go and collect water down the hill or something. So he propped up all his fellows all around the walls and lent their spears against them. So it looked like the castle had been relieved by another set of soldiers. And so when the enemy came back, they thought, oh, no, it's been relieved. There's a load more soldiers to kill. Sod it, we're going somewhere else. they went away, and he managed to defend the castle. And the relevance of that is that the birds may be singing a repertoire of other species' song, effectively to say, this territory is completely full, there's loads of us in here, so there's no point in trying to come in and take part of this territory because there's a lot of defenders already. Okay. So the Beau Geste idea of why they might have a repertoire copying lots of individuals is to defend the territory better by making it appear fuller.
This morning I've come to visit wildlife artist, author and educator Gordon Darcy. He lives just north of the Burren. He has let his garden go wild, and it's a great place to listen for birdsong.
Is birdsong something that you've always been aware of?
Yes. I don't know whether it's because I have a musical ear or not, but I noticed even as a child I could pick up birdsong quicker than anybody else. And I knew all the songs of the birds by the time I was a teenager. I love imparting that kind of skill to children. Sometimes children find it difficult to differentiate between, they just hear a cacophony of sound in the background, but I try to get them to think of associative words or phrases, like the repetition of the song thrush, for instance, or the tunelessness of the dunnock. It's very monotonic.
The speed of the wren.
Oh, the speed, the energy of the wren.
Yeah.
Words like that, if you can remember those words and associate them with the bird, then the song, you'll know where the song's coming from after a while. And I listen at this time of the year for the arrival of the songbirds from Africa, from the summer birds. The chiff-chaff is first, and then you hear the twitter of the sand martins out in the fen after that. And then willow warbler, black cap, sedge warbler, grasshopper warbler, and then later on in April, the cuckoo.
Do you have a favourite bird song?
Well, the cuckoo is my favourite, definitely the cuckoo. And I anticipate it right throughout the month of April. And when it first calls, it's like an old friend coming back.
I always find every year, for me, there's a morning I look forward to. And it's when they suddenly wake up, and it's like every willow warbler has just arrived on the one wind. And suddenly, where one day you go to bed one evening, not a single willow warbler in the country. The next day you wake up and there is one singing from every hedge in the entire country. It's an amazing thing.
It's a real,
for me, birdsong gives me a real calendar in the year. You know, there's the first, as you say, the first cuckoo, or there's the first willow warbler, the first chiff-chaff. It gives a lovely sense of the year if you tune into it.
Absolutely, and this is something I try to get across through educational work when I go to schools. I think it's a great a great avenue of approach for kids to learn about nature, because they can use their senses, they can look and they can listen, and they can go out from the school and around the school grounds and do their own censusing, which is a great piece of scientific work. In fact, it's, you know, it's very rudimentary, but it's an insight into the analysis of data, shall we say. In this day and age, when kids are confined mostly into PlayStations or stuck in front of computer games or the computer, it's great to have this avenue of interest and entrance into nature, you know?
I mean, there isn't a human-composed piece of music like it, because for me, it's like any... If you can imagine an orchestra, but anyone can join in that orchestra making any tune they want at any time. And it works.
Yeah.
So you can have a dawn chorus that sounds perfect, and then suddenly in the foreground, a wren will start calling, or a great tit will call. And it just adds to it. And it never clashes.
No. There's a certain natural kind of harmony in natural sounds, whereas man-made sounds can be discordant if they're not timed right, if they're not harmonised. Again, with education, if we go out to, say, a habitat or a stream or whatever, I get the kids to close their eyes and listen to the sound of a stream flowing. Yeah. And, you know, you ask them afterwards, is that a pleasant sound or an unpleasant sound? And invariably they say it's a pleasant sound. And they would equate that to bird song, which is also a pleasant sound. And then you compare that with, say, the sound of a chainsaw or the sound of a lawnmower or the sound of someone working with a hammer. Are those pleasant sounds?
Yeah.
Invariably not. So natural sounds have... they're pleasant and they're soothing, and kids can recognise that even at a very young age, which is quite remarkable.
Is it something, do you think, it's something that we've lost contact with?
I think so. I think, unfortunately, it's not as prevalent as it used to be, that people recognise the different sounds of the birds. There's a distancing there, a disconnect that's prevailing, I think, through Western society. This beautiful little country road beside the house here often has people jogging or walking for recreational purposes, and it's sad to see them completely wired for sound with earphones and so on, and the wires going down to a machine at their waist, and clearly engaged in what's coming through the wires and not engaged in any way in what's going on around them. They're missing out on the sounds of nature, they're missing out on colours and textures as well of the countryside. And that's a pity. And that's a change too. I mean, that's only happened in the last 10 or 15 years.
I was reading something recently. I came across an article about Alder Hey Hospital, Children's Hospital in Liverpool, and how there's Chris Watson, who's a famous sort of natural history sound recorder, and he came up with a project where they introduced bird song into hospital wards.
Yeah.
And they found that a hugely positive and beneficial effect. The kids are actually more relaxed when birdsong is being played, and that's measurable, and that they go to sleep better. Which I can understand that. Going to sleep to the sound of birdsong instead of trolleys and beeps and bangs at the machines, you know those?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think it's good for sort of human well-being?
Yep, I do. I think we need things that we can rely on, that we can fall back on, shall we say. When everything else seems mayhem and madness. You know, I'm very lucky where I live here. I'm within 400 metres of the ocean and an inlet from the sea, and it's full of birds. So in the morning, every morning without fail, I go down for a walk there and I come back, you know, rejuvenated, even if I'm tired to start with. So there is solace, there's comfort, I think, in nature. There's a kind of stability in it. You know, there's a reliance for humans in it, I think. You can trace this right back through history to Shakespeare's time, to the people who wrote about nature, like Aristotle and Plato in ancient Greece. So it's something that is, I suppose, the way the human condition can refresh itself through nature, and particularly through birdsong, which, as I say, I think is the top of natural sounds.
In this episode, we've considered the science of why birds sing and how they sing, but sometimes you've just got to sit back, relax, and enjoy it.